When you talk about hairdressing, Herbert's salon is synonymous with the hairdressing scene around there. I mean, but there must have been a big long path that took you to that wonderful establishment that you've got down there in Liverpool One. So let's go back a few years.
How far?
Don't know. Well, you know,
when I first went my apprenticeship.
Yeah. Well, where are you from? In what part of the world of Liverpool are you on?
Stonycroft.
Right.
Really old Swan.
Right.
But my mother used to say it's got to be Stonycroft Herbert. Right. You know, they got this like a bit like a Mrs. Bouquet.
Yeah.
Oh no, we come from Stonycroft. But in actual fact, it is. It's right. A suburb of Old Swan. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, with my mother and father. My father was a teacher.
Yeah.
And my brother and sister. Yeah. So we had I had a great childhood, and so the family were great parents. Yeah. You know.
What kind of stuff did you excel in when you were a child at school?
Being cheeky, I think.
Cheeky.
I remember saying to the teachers, you know, if you just teach me pounds, shillings and pence, I will be fine, because I wanted to go into theatre, really, when I was a youngster.
Yeah.
So, of course, I went to dancing school with my sister, and I went to the school for about eight years it was.
Yeah.
And then I actually was one of the Carol Levis discoveries, it was a bit like Huey Green.
Right.
Many years ago. But Carol Levis was synonymous with discovering young talent.
Yeah.
So I was a Carol Levis discovery, and I used to be on theatre with Lisa Rosa and Jimmy Clitheroe. I can go back a lot.
What's the Lisa Rosa song? There's a very famous song that she did.
How much is that dog in the window?
That's the one. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Yeah.
So I was pantomime then. That was at the Pavilion Theatre. Then I was with the Ovaltinis, and then the Backyard Kids with Jack. Yeah, it was a lovely, lovely childhood, because that's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And even when I was in school, I wanted to do, you know, to go on stage all the time, you know. So with my sister, it just, she met a boyfriend when she was about 15, and we were like a double act. We were like a Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire act, and we used to open up shows, you know. Yeah. And I used to play a piano accordion.
Right.
So when she met this boyfriend, it was, you know, she wanted to give it all up. And I didn't have, would you believe it, I didn't have enough confidence to be able to do it on my own.
Right.
And I never thought about anything else. And then my mother turned around to me and said to me, she was putting hydrogen peroxide on her hair. Now, she had dark roots, you see, and blonde hair. So she used to do it with a toothbrush. And she used to put in 0.880 ammonia, which are two spots of ammonia you used to buy from the chemist those days.
Right.
That activates the peroxide. That's a technical term, really.
Yeah.
And
then
she said to me, would you put it on my roots here? But just put the watery, I was like a watery consistency, you know, and she, with the toothbrush. And as I'm doing it, I saw the hair changing from dark brown.
Yeah.
To medium brown, to like an orangey colour.
Right.
From orange, you know, to and it went lighter and lighter until it got blonde. And I thought, you know, within half an hour, I'd changed something completely. So to me, that was magical.
Right.
It was really magical. And so that's what made me want to do hairdressing.
Right.
So
the entertainment career kind of took a back seat to that then.
It did, in actual fact, yes, which is a shame, really, because I love the... I love everything about the theatre.
Hmm.
So, yes, it did take a back seat.
So back in the time when you were you've been inspired to do this because your mother's given you the opportunity and that, what were the opportunities? Because obviously becoming a barber would have been relatively straightforward, but if you wanted to be a creative hairdresser, was there much opportunity back then?
Not really, because you had to pay a premium those days. So the salon that I went to was called Hills, and it was a very, very upmarket... really, really upmarket salon in Bold Street, at the bottom of Bold Street. In those days, Bold Street was like London. You know, you're talking about Bond Street, you know, the ladies with the fair coats and, you know. It was such a special street in Liverpool those days.
Mm.
So we to be able to get an apprenticeship was 100 guineas, which my father and mother could not afford.
Yeah.
So I went for the interview to Hills, and, you know, I told him we couldn't afford it, and he said to me that, well, there'd be no possibility, because those days you paid to learn hairdressing. They never paid you.
Right.
So it was a craft. It was a totally different, although it was an apprenticeship.
Mm.
You know, you had to pay to learn it. So I remember flattering him, because after my interview, I went home and I rung him up and I told him, Mr. Hill, you know... I've got an opportunity to work in this Andre Bernard's then. It was a huge big salon. In actual fact, Jimmy Tarbuck
worked
in Andre Bernard's. And I said, but I don't really want to go and work there, Mr. Hill. I'd rather work for you. I was telling a small lie, you know, but I just really wanted to go to work for this company. Mm. Anyway, I flattered him so much that he said, I'll telephone you back. And he telephoned us back and said, you know, you can start on Monday, Herbert, but you must never tell anybody, you know. That.
So you bypassed the 100 guineas?
I bypassed that, yes.
Yeah.
But I loved every single minute of being there because it was such a culture change, really, because from a young boy from Old Swan, I was put in this world of beautiful women. And also the clientele was a Lady Derby who was bought in a chauffeur-driven Rolls-Royce. Mm. Lady Pilkington, the Larranaga Shipping Company, you know, all the different...
Your high society.
Oh, it was. It really was. And I liked it. Yeah. You know, I just... Well, as a young boy, to see that, you know, it's something really special, you know, to be able to be part of that. And then to be taught how to mix in that sort of a circle, how to talk to this type of clientele. So it was, you know, they have a finishing school for girls.
Yeah.
This was a finishing school for a boy.
Yeah, just for one.
I thought so. And it was, I used to get £1.19 a week. And I used to go to the Adelphi Hotel once a week on a Friday for my lunch. Mm. I didn't have any food. Had a pot of coffee for 7 and 6 pence.
Right.
Which is like nearly a third of your salary. It's nearly a third of your salary.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but the clients used to say to me, where have you been for your... And I said, oh, I've just been to the Adelphi and I had a pot of coffee. And they used to say, a pot of coffee? Can you afford a pot of coffee? Why'd you go to the Adelphi? And I went, well, I like the Adelphi because those days there was a quintet there. You know, you'd have the pianist and the violinist and everything. And it was ever so, because it was the flagship, the Adelphi, of the hotels in Great Britain. It was very special to go in there. Mm-hmm. And I love the opulence of that hotel.
Yeah.
So I said, oh, yes. I said, it might be expensive, but you can get 10 cups out of a pot. So, you know, I couldn't drink the 10 cups, but I just loved everything
being
about
in that ambience.
Yes, it was absolutely fabulous to me.
Right.
And so from there, I just loved everything about my apprenticeship. In fact, if I could do it again, I would. Mm. You know,
maybe that's somebody ringing up to give you an opportunity.
Probably, you know what? It's probably Simon Ross. You know, I'm so sorry about that. That's not like me.
Oh, don't worry.
No, so, you know, and for the journey from that time that I finished my apprenticeship has been absolutely amazing, really.
Well, I know, obviously, we've got to condense it into the time
of course,
that we've got.
I understand.
But when did you decide that, well, I've had enough of working for other people, I'm going to start working for me?
17.
At 17?
At 17. I opened my first salon in West Derby Road with £100 at 17.
Yeah.
And by the time I was 19...
I take it Lady Derby and Lady Pilkington.
Well, no, do you know what? You'll love this. Because the day I opened the salon with my mother, she was my receptionist. Hmm. And there was only myself and her, you see. So the day I opened, this young lady came in. And the culture shock was... I said, how would you like your hair? And she went, dead eye, dead wide, lot of lacquer. I said, pardon? She went, dead eye, dead wide, lot of lacquer. So I said, to everybody who's listening now, that means dead high, dead wide, and a lot of lacquer.
Yeah.
And it was totally different to what I had been trained to do. But it was something that was necessary because it gave me an opportunity to work in the suburbs.
Yeah.
And I relate to all sorts of people, so it made no difference, did it? Mm. And I loved it.
Yeah.
So by the time I was 19, I had 44 staff, and I've never had less than 44 staff.
At 19, you had 44 staff?
I did. And I had three salons by the time I was 19.
Right.
And then I've never had less than 44 staff since then. And the most staff I've had is about 167.
Wow. Blimey. That's incredible.
It says, I don't know how I've done it, really.
Yeah.
I don't know how I've done it.
When all this was going on, and obviously the business is successful, how did you occupy your time away from hairdressing? What did you do social-wise?
Nothing at all.
Nothing.
I never went to a club or until I was 24 years of age.
Really?
Yeah, I was working, wasn't I?
Yeah.
I used to get all the towels, the laundry all sorted out, and sometimes my last client would be 11 o'clock at night.
Right.
But you see, it was my hobby. And from 17 years of age, I don't belong to the hairdressing industry. The hairdressing per se, I belong to the hairdressing industry.
Hmm.
So, you know, the industry is worldwide.
Right.
So I embellished myself right into the industry by, I was always in London. So then I become the guild master for hairdressing.
Right.
Well, I was a bit old. I was about 28 when I was a guild master, but I'd done an awful lot before that.
Right.
And that's like having 36,000 salons in your control. It's a lot of salons, I think.
That's incredible. Yeah. So what do you think then? I mean, because you mentioned earlier, because you, I got the impression you were saying you were quite an introverted kind of person.
No.
No?
Not at all.
Oh, right. Sorry, I thought you weren't compared to where you are now. Would you say you're a bigger personality, or have you always been consistent?
Yes, I think I'm always been consistent. More confident, probably,
that's,
now.
That's what I meant.
More confident then, yeah, because, I mean, I wasn't established as much then.
Yeah.
And my aim was to be the top hairdresser that you could ever meet in the country, and I achieved that.
Mm.
You know, I did achieve.
Right.
My claim to fame is I brought Vidal Sassoon in second in a hairdressing competition.
You beat him?
No, I brought him in.
Oh,
I was the judge.
Oh, right.
Yes, and he came in second.
What about the client base that you've got? I mean, I don't know whether or not there's some kind of like oath of confidentiality here, but kind of people come to you to get the Barnet done?
Well, don't forget now, I mean, I've been doing hairdressing now for 55 years.
Right.
So I've been in my business for 52 years.
Yeah.
So my clientele, when they started, some of the clients were maybe 25.
Mm-hmm.
So now, if you look at them, they're 80 years of age.
Right.
You know, so they have diminished, I have to say.
Yeah.
If I wanted to be humorous about them, most of my clients have got fluffy slippers and incontinent knickers on. But most of the clientele that I've had over the years,
yeah.
You know, I've had some fantastic clients.
Yeah.
I mean, when I started off, I mean, I could tell you that one of the film stars that ever came into me was Maze Etterling.
Right, yeah.
And then I did Alma Cogan's hair.
Yeah.
And a lot, not so many young people would know that, but a lot of, I've gone right through the,
What was it like when you, if you got a celebrity coming in, do you get a bit nervous thinking, oh my God, there's a lot, right? No? Just the same as any other client?
Yes. Right. Sandy Shaw was in,
yeah,
not too long ago in the salon. You know, we have so many, I hate to call in them wags, but footballers' wives.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we had, you know, there's quite a lot that've come through.
Well, that must be from your point of view. If you get these people who are being photographed all the time, you think, well, it's only like wearing a dress. They're wearing your design, if you like it. They're wearing your artwork, aren't they?
Yeah, really. I've tried to always be the Harrods of hairdressing.
Yeah,
you know, everyone says to me, you know, what have you always wanted to accomplish? I say the Harrods of hairdressing, to be able to give somebody something that they pay for, but more. I want to give them more than what they pay for.
Yeah.
I want to give them the service standards of fantastic hairdressers.
Mm.
So that's always been my aim, and I've been able to do that, which is a long time, really, to be still in the top, say, four in the city for 52 years.
That's not bad going.
Oh, no, it isn't.
What about the television series? How did that come about?
Now, which one were you talking about?
The salon one. Is there another one? See, I must have should have researched a bit more. There was one, was it?
Shampoo?
The one that was at Yvette Field Inn.
No, that was the last one.
That was
the first one I ever did was Shampoo.
And when was that?
On ITV.
Right.
And that was, oh gosh, I would say 14 years ago.
Right.
And that went worldwide.
Yeah.
And it was one of the first reality shows that was ever done. In fact, mine was the first hairdressing reality show that was ever done.
Yeah.
And they came into my salon and they were with me for 9 months.
Mm.
And then it was like a fly on the wall, but to me it became like a wasp. They followed me. They did. They followed me. But at that time, I was doing pantomime at the time. And Jeremy Spake, who was in Airport, had the executive producer for that in BBC. His name was John Farron. And ITV had poached John Farron and asked him, would he make a reality TV of a hairdressing company? And he said, would you go to Liverpool? And at the time, I was playing one of the ugly sisters with Stan Boardman on at the Royal Court.
Yeah.
And he did come up and he came to the salon. We had two salons, one in the Moat House Hotel and one right opposite, which was in Paradise Street.
Yeah.
Well, there was 82 staff there and there was 300 students. So he then visited me at the theatre while I was all dressed up as the ugly sister.
Yeah.
And I had to greet this man. So he goes, I never thought I'd be able to do, you know, a programme. Yeah. On a hairdressing salon. Mm. But looking around, he said, I've got all the ingredients of a great programme. And it was.
It was ITV.
We went on, you know, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Yeah.
What has just come out? Right?
When it just come out?
When has it just come out? So we went on after Coronation Street on a Friday and just before Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
That's a good slot, isn't it?
8 o'clock on Fridays and Monday, Wednesday and Friday for 6 weeks.
You must have enjoyed that period.
I did. You know why? Because I could be myself.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't. It was just cameras everywhere and all the staff could be themselves. Mm. But they've got great poetic license, haven't they?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When you know they can edit all.
And edit it.
They can edit it all. Mm. And in actual fact, that's what they did the end. ITV thought it was too funny. So they decided to re-edit it in London.
Really? Cut a bit of it out?
Lots of it.
Really?
All the fun parts out and made it slightly more.
Why would they do that?
Well, John Farren actually said to us, look, Herbert, I can tell you now that I'm not working for them. I'm working for Scottish TV. He rung me and he said, that was the biggest travesty of television I have ever been part of. Mm. You, in actual fact, he said, we could have done a series on your company and yourself in 2 weeks. He said we could have
done.
He said we had that much material,
yeah.
And it was so funny, Herbert. But the most the strange part about doing something like that and being put in the public eye was, I was asked then to go on This Morning in London, so I went into the television studios for This Morning in ITV television studios, and it's all in glass, you know, and then there's a big reception desk, and there, just of me, was a 35-foot photograph as the backdrop for with shampoo on, you know, for the reception. Wherever I went, there was a full page in the Daily Mail. If I went down in the, you know, the underground, I remember standing waiting for one of the tubes, and the tube was already in, and I didn't want that tube, but I was on the platform.
Yeah.
And as the tube went out, there are posters just of me. With the hairdryer in the hand, shampoo, ITV, you know.
Oh.
And we did. And we went from 6.4 million the first week to 7.2 the following week.
Blimey.
To 8 million the following week.
Yeah.
But we had a lot of viewers, you know. In fact, at that particular time, Cilla Black only had 4.5 million for...
Blimey.
Surprise.
Incredible. Yeah.
So we did really, really well.
Yeah.
But when I was in London, they ran after me wherever I went.
Yeah.
And I found that quite frightening. So, you know, to be, say, I look at people like Beckham and I think to myself, oh, my God, I'm so pleased.
Yeah.
And not somebody, you know, as famous as he is.
Yeah.
Because a minute's not your own. Yeah. You know, you can never really enjoy yourself as just as an ordinary human being, can you?
Mm.
They used to run after me in Harrods. I had to run. You've no idea. It was hysterical.
Yeah.
Then I get in a taxi and the fellow would turn around and go, oh, my God, my wife loves you.
Yeah.
And I'd go, just take me to the hotel, which the television studios had booked me. But then I went into Coronation Street and they took me everywhere.
Yeah. That's incredible.
It was incredible, actually.
Well, obviously, I mean, you still enjoy what you're doing.
Yeah, I love it.
But you also do a lot of charity as well, will you?
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit about the charity that you're involved in.
It's called Queenie's Christmas.
Yeah.
My mother worked for me for 32 years.
Mm.
So, and she loved children. And Christmas was a great time for my mother. You know, in fact, her favourite person was Father Christmas.
Right.
And she had little ornaments of Father Christmas in the house. Now, we're not talking about an everyday lady who likes brass and everything. We're talking about a very glamorous woman, really. She looked like Lana Turner.
Right.
So you wouldn't think that she'd have a model of Father Christmas in the house because it didn't look
not
like...
Not fit with the character.
Didn't fit with the character, it didn't. And she got Parkinson's for the last 12 years of her life. And I always wondered what I could do that, you know, for her to remember her by. Mm. So I remember saying to her one day, "Mum, would you like me to look after children and to look after people on Christmas Day?" And I remember she was in bed at the time in the hospital, and she said, "That would be lovely." So I said, "I'm going to call it Queenie's Christmas." And she was absolutely, you have the smile on her face, you know. Mm. I don't think she realised what I was going to do. But I knew if I was going to do it right, I was going to do it right. Mm. And of course, when she died, that's when I started, right? And the idea was Christmas Day was her favourite day. And then I thought, right, we'll look after people who are on their own at Christmas Day. So I got in touch with the social services, and they said, "Did you know, Herbert, that there are more suicides on Christmas Day than any other day in the year?" Mm. Very surprising to me that, you know, to even think that you might have somebody who was old, Nate, living next door to you, that you could just say, "Would you like to come in and have lunch with us?" Or if you didn't want to, just say, "I've made you a nice lunch, Christmas lunch," you know. Just make their Christmas, not your own, because there's a lot of selfishness, in, I think, in the world today, you know. Mm. So anyway, I went to the Adelphi Hotel and they said, "That's fine, we can do Christmas Day for you." They were very good with me. And on this particular Christmas Day, when I got there, I was wondering how I was going to... I got ad-lib the lighting.
The audio guys, yeah.
Yes, because I knew them from the pantomime days, from the Royal Court, the lighting. And they said, "We'll light, do a stage for you and everything," you know. And it was beautiful how it was all set up. And I wondered, how am I going to entertain these people? I could usually do, you know, older people, I'm fine, or... But it wasn't all about old people. It was about people on their own. In fact, I used to get in touch with the Empire Theatre because there are some dancers that, you know, are from different parts of the country, and they would be on their own on Christmas Day. They would come and spend it with us. You know, just let's all celebrate together. Anyway, well, by the time I got there, there's a line of people sitting down at the Adelphi. This was about 12 o'clock lunchtime.
Yeah.
Billy Butler.
Yeah.
Ricky Tomlinson. There wasn't Claire Sweeney at the time. All these entertainers
had turned up.
And I said, "What's he doing here?" And he said, "We've come to help you." Wow. Well, they found out. So we had about 300 or 400 people on that day, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, it's been going now 9 years. And we've always had a... and so my patrons are Jennifer Allison, Claire Sweeney, Ricky Tomlinson, Billy Butler, Pete Price, Danny McCall, Esther McVeigh. So they're all my because
people who support it.
Yeah, they are very good. Yeah. You know, I mean, Claire Sweeney is a great friend of mine, but she, to see her come in there on Christmas Day, and to be able to see her looking after all the people and walking round the tables. Yeah. I mean, it's all ways of service. But she goes round to say, "Hello, how are you?" Gets her photographs taken. You don't have to do that. You know, when you're in a situation like Claire is. But I think she's a wonderful girl, you know. It shows the character of the people who are helping me, you know. But then Claire will stay an hour and she'll go, and that's fine by me. Ricky Tomlinson wanted to stay all day.
I can believe that.
So I said, "Well, bring your family." So you bring his family.
Yeah.
A great, great.
Yeah.
But it's gone from there. Now, I've got 1,100 victims of crime and sheltered accommodation, and I do that at the Devonshire House Hotel. And it's worked with the Merseyside Police. So that's on the 15th, 16th and 17th of December, I have got the four Christmas lunches, right? And I put great artists on. And then on the 14th of December, I do a big Christmas party for Zoe's Place. For the children. And then the law town hall, I used to do the Christmas party for underprivileged children, but we've moved it away from there now, and I take 1,000 children, which I'm taking on the 9th of December, to Gulliver's Christmas World.
Oh, yeah.
And they're children in care. Also 500 of the Variety Club.
Yeah.
With Cash for Kids as well.
Yeah.
Which is associated with the,
of course,
you know. But the more the kids, the merrier. If I could take 1,500, I'd take 1,500. If I've got them, I want them. So, and then I take 300 to 500 children to the pantomime. And then the first charity I got hold of that I wanted to look after was Bernardo's Young Carers. And I went to Bernardo's and I said, "Do you have young carers?" And he said, "We have 150 of them, Herbert." So I said, "Oh." So I said, "What ages are they?" So they went, "Well, from the age of 6 up to 18. So I was with Joyce, who works with me, my company secretary, and she said, what does a six-year-old do? And the six-year-old gets up in the morning, puts the washing machine on, and takes their mother a pot of yoghurt.
Right. Yeah.
But these are children with one-parent families.
Yeah, yeah.
So these children are dedicated to caring, and really, nobody sees what these children do. They're not street children. They're absolutely, they're wonderful children. They're just little angels, how they care for this parent. So I found that at Christmas time, I said, what can I do for the children? So they said, well, Christmas presents are very difficult, Herbert, because with the mother being ill, they can't get out to get children.
To get the presents, yeah.
So they didn't get them. So now, they have a wish list, whatever they want.
Yeah.
So now we buy them all, 150 of them. It makes no difference. Yeah. Well, they've got prams and bikes and things like that. Yeah. And then they identified that some of the families didn't have food at Christmas time, you know, because it's a difficulty for them to do it. So we went to Marks and Spencer's and Tesco and we built up great big hampers, not with Earl Grey tea.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't. I went in and picked everything, all the things that you could put, microwave, you know, you can do, so the children can do it for them. So they had a big Christmas, all the crackers and all the things like that, all the balloons and everything. So we give them, so it's very rewarding to me. And then we heard of a charity called Ollie, and Ollie stands for Our Love Lost Years. And these are young people, children, who've seen a sibling of theirs, maybe sister or brother and mother, murdered. It's a terrible situation with these children because they've got trauma. It's a trauma with these children.
So
a lady set this charity up, looking after them so they can all be together and talk, you know. And so I took them over, and I didn't take them over as the complete charity, but they became part of my flock. They're my kids as far as I'm concerned. So if there's any pantomimes, they get invited. Any Christmas parties, they're invited. You know, when we're taking them to Gulliver's World, they will be invited. So I've got thousands of children. I've got thousands of... and it could still go on from there, you know.
Well, as we come towards at the end of the interview, obviously a lot more you could talk
about. Oh, I could?
Yeah. What, is there anything that you've left on your list of things to do before time beats you?
No, not really. I've thought of this many times. You know, if you were to make a bucket list, I've been very fortunate to be able to have done everything, really.
Yeah.
I've never... it's not been all work, I have to say that. It's been an amazing sort of journey.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been around the world that many times. I've done 76 cruise ships. I've had a home in Turkey. I've had my own boat. I've had my own captain. I've done everything. I've spent my money as I've gone, you know. And I've ended up with the Bling Bling building in Liverpool, which is, you know, it's going to be something that's going to, of course, it'll outlive me. And when I've gone, that would be an epitaph, I suppose, to me, really. But I was delighted when the Duke of Westminster... They asked me where I'd like my building to be built when they took me away from Paradise Street. And I picked it. And they sent up an architect from London, a very famous architect, called Piers Gough. Now, Piers Gough, when he walked through in my older salon when I was in Paradise Street, before we built the Bling Bling building, he walked in and he said, and I've never seen anybody quite like him, he had two... sticks, they were perspex, you could see through them. And he had a mop of, like the Jackson 5, grey hair, great big glasses.
You knew
he was somebody, he had to say. He was a fantastic looking man. You know, you go, oh my God, he is something special, this man. So he comes in and goes, he spoke very far back, Herbert, I've been sent up by the Duke of Westminster to build a building round your personality. And I went... You know, if somebody said that to you, you'd go, well, what do you mean? So he goes, well, I want to know what you wear. I want to know what your lifestyle is. And I will design a building around that. So I had to show him all my clothes, all the things, who the person I was, how I, you know, and that. And then he came up with the Bling Bling building. But the boxes on the outside were done in a brown zebra skin at first.
Yeah.
And it's not for me to turn round to somebody as eminent as he is and turn round and go to him, don't like that.
Don't like that.
You couldn't do that, could you? You know what I mean? So I said, oh, it's very nice. And then the Duke of Westminster, they called it the Bling Bling Building.
Yeah.
Because he said that I was the king of bling.
Right.
And I suppose that goes for the jewellery that I've always worn.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the story of the Bling Bling Building. And it's a beautiful building, I have to say.
Yeah.
But I'm ready to retire.
Yeah.
I am ready to retire now because I've passed the 70 mark.
Right.
And so I am ready to retire, but I'm ready for maybe a bigger company to come in and take me over and for me to be part of, you know, the hairdressing. I'll never be not part of the hairdressing industry because I'm very, very interested in training people and giving them the opportunity that I had when I was younger. And so if they come to me or to for training as apprenticeships, because we have over, well, we've got 170 at the moment, apprenticeships, and I've trained over 8,000 apprentices.
Yeah.
I want to give them an opportunity to learn the craft like I did. So they're very much in the forefront of my mind.
Yeah.
People would say, well, it's quite lucrative. I'm not really interested in how much money's coming in, you know, because if I can manage.
Mm.
Because, you know, you don't want to be dying with, you know, loads of money in the bank, do you?
No.
So what I do is, you know, try and give these youngsters as many opportunities whereas people from world-class hairdressers can come in and teach them. And we do have world-class hairdressers come in. Patrick Cameron was in 2 weeks ago. You've got Errol Douglas. We have Royston Bly. They do Katie Price's hair. We've got all the top hairdressers can come in and actually, you know, give these youngsters. Do you know sometimes youngsters don't see a pathway?
Yeah.
They can only, I feel sorry for them, really. You know, they don't understand that you put a goal and you aim for it. Yeah. It seems to be a mindless source of reason why they're doing work these days.
Mm.
And I mean, I look back at myself and say to myself, how did you manage to do what you did, Herbert, at 70? I don't know.
Mm.
I can't believe that I had a brain like that.
Yeah.
You know, I can't really believe because 17-year-olds don't. There are a few and far between, there might be. But, you know, it's all about helping as many people as you can because you want to give back.
Yeah. Well, Herbert, unfortunately, we're out of time.
Well, you would be because I could speak for 2 hours. I could go into the realms of everything.
Well, maybe we'll have to run it as a series there.
Well, it would be great because when I tell you that my uncle is Lloyd Bridges...
Your uncle's Lloyd Bridges?
Yes. My auntie...
Oh, look at that there near the end of it. There you throw that in.
I can do.
Jeff as in Lloyd Bridges?
As in Jeff Bridges, yes. And also, can I also tell you that my aunt was Avril Angers. Now, Avril Angers was a film star who did The Family Way with Hayley Mills.
Right.
And my auntie was a very, very famous. And my uncle was Herbert. And I was called after my uncle Herbert, who was my grandfather's brother.
Right.
He was one of the most famous hairdressers.
Yeah,
in the world.
Right.
There's a book called Hairdressing Theory by Herbert Ossie. When you talk about reincarnation, I can honestly say that there must have been something because why would I take up the same profession as my Uncle Herbert? And also, my Uncle Herbert brought over Eugène from Paris and they did the first permanent wave, cold wave, in the world.
Right.
And it was done on my aunt, who was Avril Angers, although she was an actress as well.
Yeah.
The Evan Williams shampoo bottle, if you have a look at the Evan Williams shampoo, it's a very old bottle. If you see all the waves, that was my aunt laying down, just had the cold wave perm. It all works in. So there is a background to, you know, me, I think.
Blimey.
It's quite fascinating.
I'm impressed with that. And Lloyd Bridges, come on, I love that. It was marvellous, that, especially in Airplane.
Oh, yes, yes.
Picked a bad day to stop smoking.
And you know what? Sometimes, I don't mention this often, I can say to people, you know, Lloyd Bridges, my uncle, and they go, there's a similarity to
there you. Is a similarity. As there soon is. As you said it, actually. Yeah,
there is a similarity. Yeah. Oh, there's lots of... there's no skeletons in my cupboard because I haven't got a cupboard.
Oh, well, I'll.
But I've got lots more stories, which are very interesting.
Well, we'll have to get some of them sometimes.
Why not?
Yeah,
it is.
We shall do
the
that.
The ones that I think are interesting.
Right, okay.
Probably I've told you what you want to know. I've just scratched the surface.
Yeah.
But the funny times and the funny things, oh, my God.
Well, that's what we'll do on part two. Herbert, it's been wonderful listening to you.
Has it?
And, yeah.
Do you think I've got verbal diarrhea?
I think you're very articulate.
I'm having trouble with my my mouth. I can't stop it. I find myself interesting as well.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but I do find myself, when I'm listening to the stories I'm telling, it's bringing back memories, and it's really good for me, really.
Right.
You know, because you never think of your past until somebody asks you about
it.
And when they ask you about it and you start telling your people, you go, oh, yeah, my God, yeah. But there's loads more stories.
Well, we'll have them, I promise you. You come back in and we'll do some
more. All right.
That's Herbert speaking to us on City Talk tonight. I think we need a rest now.